I do dimly perceive that whilst everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is underlying all that change a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates.
The voice of Gandhi. It was not the voice of an orator, still less of a dictator. As Jawaharlal Nehru remembered it, it was a quiet voice.
His voice never rose above a certain timbre. He never raised his voice, but it was a penetrating voice.
It was as a self-made man that he impressed the great Muslim educationalist, Dr. Zakir Hussain, who was to become the third president of the Indian Republic.
You see, in my view, one of the chief things to note in Gandhiji's life is that he was not born great. He was not born with things which usually help people to become great. He was born an ordinary man with ordinary capacities, and he literally hammered himself into shape. He chiseled himself into shape, he hammered himself into shape, as the case arose. He was a self-educated, self-made man, consciously determined to make himself an instrument of the values which he prized.
Those values, an obstinate belief in non-violence, in the guidance of God and the persuadability of man, were often to trouble and mystify Nehru, who was 20 years younger than Gandhi. But he recognized the power of leadership that they could generate.
Even when he was in South Africa, one of the leading persons in India, I went there and saw him working there and came back and described him as a man with the amazing capacity to make heroes out of men of clay.
They had to be a special kind of hero. Social discrimination against the large Indian minority in South Africa had shocked Gandhi on his first arrival as a young lawyer in 1893. Soon there was legal discrimination as well, and Gandhi became the spokesman of protest and the leader in a long struggle. One of the Europeans who stood by him and went to prison with him was the British lawyer Henry Pollack.
Yes, he felt that it was necessary to advise his people that if necessary they should go to jail in order to show that they were prepared to endure anything rather than accept this anti-Indian legislation. And this movement then took him to jail on more than one occasion.
It had been in South Africa, too, that Gandhi had made fundamental decisions about his own relation to society. As it happened, Henry Pollack played a part in this.
I went to see him off on a railway journey to Durban, and I gave him to read a book that had very greatly interested me, Ruskin's book, Unto This Last. He was so fascinated by it that he couldn't put the book down all night till he'd finished it, and he immediately decided that he must change his way of life from that of the ordinary middle-class professional person to that of a farmer and craftsman and the simple life.
That was in 1904. And so it was that in India, 18 years later, Judge Broomfield found that the man who stood before him in the Sessions Court at Ahmedabad was indicted as Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, farmer and weaver.
Yes, now you draw my attention to it. It is true that in the course of his statement, he described himself as a farmer and weaver. Actually, Mr. Gandhi was a Bunya by caste. The Bunyas are not farmers or weavers, but bankers or professional men. But it is quite true that ever since he began his political life, he identified himself with the people of the country. The weaver was also mentioned, no doubt, because he strongly believed, he was in that sense reactionary, he strongly believed in promoting village industries, weaving in the villages, with the idea of counteracting the industrialization of India.
And that meant something more basic than the village loom. It was the spinning wheel, which Gandhi revived and spread through the country for his attack on rural poverty, that became the symbol of freedom and the point of endless controversy. It is as inseparable from his public image as from the intimate picture of his ashram or settlement, which his English friends came to know, among them the young Quaker Reginald Reynolds.
I always remember him pointing to his spinning wheel and saying, "It's quite wrong to say I don't believe in machinery. This is a beautiful piece of machinery." But he judged all machines, and in fact he judged every form of material progress by what it contributed or took away from life.
Therefore, I want simple machines, not big monsters which nobody can possess.
This is Morris Friedman, Polish by birth, engineer by training, helper in Gandhi's rural work by choice.
He said, "My ideal is a machine which anybody can have. I personally feel that man comes first. What is good for man is good for Gandhiji. What is not good for man is not good for Gandhiji. But the difficulty arises in judgment, in the judgment of what is good."
And also, quite practically, in the judgment of what is immediately necessary. Dr. Hussain.
I don't think Gandhiji would have insisted on the spinning wheel for all time. Gandhiji was one of the most rational thinkers I have come across. I am quite sure Gandhi was not primitive by principle at all. He was primitive out of necessity, out of the necessity of the situation, because the primitive at that time, the apparently primitive at the time, was the only practical thing to do.
Out of the necessity of the situation again, Gandhi was prepared to recruit soldiers for the British Empire when it was fighting for survival in the First World War. And out of principle, too, India must earn her title to national freedom, and Britain must be trusted to recognize it. But the recognition that came after the war in a new plan for constitutional advance lost much of its effect when the government of India, alarmed by post-war restlessness, brought in special security laws. Though these powers were never used, they were deeply resented. Gandhi organized his own campaign of protest on the principles that he had tried out in South Africa, and without the support of political nationalism as represented by the Indian National Congress. But in the Punjab, which he was not allowed to enter, the face of violence showed itself. Troops fired upon an unarmed crowd at Amritsar, and martial law was clamped down on the province. And on Gandhi's home ground in Bombay and Ahmedabad, rioting and bloodshed had disfigured his movement. He suspended his campaign, fasted in repentance, and helped the authorities to restore calm and order. In Morris Friedman's view, it was the kind of readjustment that he would often have to make.
As usually, overestimated the non-violence of his followers. He did like everybody else does. He judged others by himself. And his continually repeated mistake was overestimation of people, putting too much faith. But that was also his greatness.
And presently, it came to be seen that Gandhi's faith and his unique appeal to the masses were indispensable in the movement for independence. Political nationalism had up to now been the concern of the wealthy and professional classes on the one hand, and on the other, of terrorist revolutionaries. Gandhi rejected both approaches. In tremendous tours through the countryside, he took his message to the grassroots. The effect was something that Nehru never forgot.
It was a wonderful change. After all, he said something very simply in those early days to the peasants and others. "Don't be afraid." It's a very simple thing to say. But the amazing thing was that they were not afraid after that. They somehow got courage. And a poor peasant, half starving, his back broken by suffering and all kinds of things, simply straightened his back and was not afraid. This is an astonishing change over the countryside.
But there had to be a change at the top. For the Indian National Congress, a new approach, a new organization, a startling new program of nonviolent action. For its leaders, at least outwardly, a new way of life.
When he came into the political field in a big way and made, well, rather astounding proposals, asking, for instance, lawyers to give up their practice and live simply and on next to nothing. Everybody to wear hand-spun clothes made in the villages. The whole atmosphere changed, and many of our older leaders who wanted to cooperate with him, nevertheless, were not quite clear what all this meant, because they had been thinking differently. There was a conflict for some months, maybe a year.
And maybe much longer. The South Indian leader, Rajagopalachari, took a look at non-violence.
That was not the reason why they preferred Gandhiji's plan. They preferred Gandhiji's plan because it was the only possible plan and it looked efficient. A new technique, that was the attraction. His sainthood and his good quality was an incident to that technique. You want a good man to use that new technique, and here he was. But that was not the point of attention. I had completely lost hope in the program of the Congress so far as the moderates went, and I was an extremist. But I was also convinced that sporadic violence would produce no good results, and as to organized violence, it was an impossibility.
But could non-violence be organized as a dynamic assault on power? Wouldn't that be a contradiction? Pyarelal Nair had to work it out for himself.
No, there was no contradiction between non-violence and his political goal, because he wanted political independence for the least in the land. He said the least, the weakest in the country, even the halt and the lame, must be able to enjoy the full measure of independence and the fruits of independence with the tallest. So it had got to be a battle which the weakest and the least could wage with equal success. And that was the moral battle. And therefore, non-violence. Non-violence thus became the means as well as the end.
So began the first mass movement of non-cooperation under Gandhi's leadership. With his eye on the means, he saw a heaven-sent chance of uniting Hindus and Muslims in a common effort that might dissolve their differences. As to the end, freedom might mean different things to different people, and something else again to Gandhi. But he told the people that if they followed his program, if the ruled simply withdrew their obedience to the rulers, accepting suffering but avoiding violence, freedom was theirs to take, and quickly, even within a year. Tens of thousands went willingly to jail. Thousands more were ready to follow them. The forces of authority seemed fully extended. And the last big push had been signalled by Gandhi when the news of an isolated act of ferocious mob violence caused him to call off the whole political operation. His colleagues, and especially Jawaharlal Nehru and his father Motilal, both of them in prison, felt stunned and angry. The boy who was to become Nehru's brother-in-law, Rajahati Singh, was one of those who had just offered himself as a volunteer when the chance of action and sacrifice vanished.
It was the great disappointment. Here was a man who was willing to give up all that politics meant to me for a mere idea. And I was really disappointed. I thought that this way there was going to be no salvation, at least in my lifetime.
And so far, no hand had been laid on Gandhi himself. He had published articles that were openly and deliberately seditious, challenging the government to arrest him. And now at last, the challenge was accepted. On March the 18th, 1922, for the first and last time, Gandhi stood to be sentenced by a British judge. And with him to answer the same charge stood the publisher of his weekly papers, Mr. Shankarlal Banka.
The conduct of the trial was, to my mind, very perfect. The judge was very courteous, very nice, capable of understanding what was in Gandhiji's mind. I think he must have sympathized also with the objects which Gandhiji put forth, but he had to do his duty in terms of the law.
It was not really a trial, since both of the accused had already pleaded guilty at the magistrate hearing, and now did so again. All that Judge Broomfield had to decide was the sentence.
He had brought a long written statement with him, which he obviously wished to read. I felt pretty sure that the statement was likely to be political propaganda, not having very much bearing on the only issue, which was the amount of the sentence. However, I saw no objection to his reading it. I allowed him to do so. That, I think, was one reason why he was pleased with his trial. I let him have his say. The other reason was that I treated him politely. As a matter of fact, it never occurred to me to do anything else. It was a long statement. To sum it up very briefly, he recorded his services to the government, which were considerable, and he explained at some length the course of events which had led him to change his mind and come to the conclusion that the laws administered by the British government were not in the interest of the Indian people and should not be obeyed. He also, at one stage, expressed the view that I, as the judge, ought to resign my post. But I'm quite sure that he did not expect me to resign, and that he was not really speaking to me at all, but to a much larger audience outside the Sessions Court of Arm of the Bed.
The sentence, too, reached that larger audience. 6 years simple imprisonment on 3 counts. And the quiet words of the judgment.
In the course of my judgment, I said this. I do not forget that you have consistently preached against violence, and that you have on many occasions, as I am willing to believe, done much to prevent violence. Then, as to that point, I went on to say, but having regard to the nature of your political teaching and the nature of many of those to whom it was addressed, how you could have continued to believe that violence would not be the inevitable consequence, it passes my capacity to understand.
The great trial, as it came to be called, had taken less than 2 hours. When the doors of Yeravada Central Prison near Pune closed upon Gandhi, it looked as if he was finished. The Viceroy, Lord Reading, thought so. So did Gandhi's political rivals, and perhaps not a few of his supporters. The acute attack of appendicitis that made headline news after he had been there a couple of years might indeed have finished him. But it led to the remission of the remaining sentence, and it added to the legend. Patrick Quinn, as a young assistant at Yeravada, began what was to be a repeated experience of Gandhi as a prisoner.
Chiefly the fact that he was simple. And honest, you know. You knew that when you talked to him, there was no double shuffling going on. But again, you also realized he was one jump ahead of you. You know what I mean? He was always, what I would say, a model prisoner. Because he always believed in sticking to the rules. He was quite... he was very good at producing some reason why the rules could be bent. You see. But otherwise, I mean, you never had much trouble apart from the fact that he, if there was something that he couldn't agree with and he couldn't get his way, hunger strike was threatened, you see, and nobody wanted that. You couldn't sell him a pup, if you know what I mean.
Nobody could do that. The freedom that he wanted for India must be won without bloody revolution and, if possible, with British cooperation. And it had to be based in social regeneration, self-help, the rescue of the villages from degradation, an end to Hindu-Muslim rivalry, removal of the blot of untouchability, and the full emancipation of India's women. To build these things, he parted company with the dogmatists and the power-seekers. But whenever the political struggle gathered momentum, he was there to lead it in his own way. In 1930, under a new viceroy, Lord Owen, Gandhi took command of a fresh wave of unrest, but he knew that his way was not the way of others. Reginald Reynolds was staying in his ashram at the time.
Gandhi said, looking up from his spinning wheel, "They're throwing bombs at Irwin now. It will be my turn next." He was so gay that I thought he was joking. The others who were listening looked shocked and incredulous.
And incredulity was the first reaction to Gandhi's plan for the opening move of a new campaign, which came to him, he said, in a dream. With a band of picked and trained followers, he proposed to march 241 miles from his ashram to the coast, there to defy the government's salt taxation laws by the ludicrously simple process of gathering salt deposited by the sea. Having notified the Viceroy of his intention in a long letter, he led his party out in the early hours of March the 12th, 1930. Glawney Bolton of the Times of India, who had watched them start, followed by Carr to their first halt in the evening.
Eventually I came to a house with a large courtyard, and I was amazed that a man so old as Gandhi was able to walk so far in one day. And there he was, sitting quite peacefully, quite happy. People round him, on the whole very quiet, but now and again you heard Gandhi break out that wonderful boyish laughter of his. He didn't know how the march was going to end. He didn't know how the sort of struggle which he had started was going to end. But nonetheless, there I was, seeing history happen in a strange sort of anticlimax way, something completely un-European and yet very, very moving.
In the first place, Gandhi didn't know or expect that he would reach Dandi, the appointed spot on the coast, without interruption. But the government made no move against him. Gandhi completed his long march. One of his companions was Krishnalal Sridharani.
It was early in the morning, and Dandi is a very beautiful seashore. Always on the sand, there are some deposits of salt left when the water is receded. So he just picked it up, a pinch of salt, you know, and gave it to the next person who was standing by. I don't recollect his or her name. And that was a symbol of breaking the Salt Act. And, of course, all the correspondents that were trailing us, especially trailing Gandhi, kept us also informed about what was happening in the country.
There was not a policeman in sight on that seashore. But what was happening in the country when the mounting expectation was broken by that signal for nationwide action sent 60,000 people into jail. It was only when two isolated but serious cases of armed disturbance forced the Viceroy's hand that a police party in the dead of night aroused Gandhi and his companions in their village quarters under a mango tree.
In the midst of that excitement, there was one man who was completely unmoved and very quiet and very self-composed, and that was Gandhiji. He asked the police superintendent to have to give him time to brush his teeth, and he brushed his teeth with a twig like any other Indian in presence of the policemen and all of us. Then he asked the police superintendent to read out the warrant, and he was behaving as if nothing extraordinary was happening.
And so, this time without trial, under an old regulation, back to Yerravada jail, and to the care of Patrick Quinn.
I met him at the gate, and he was very pleased to see me, and laughed quite heartily. He just said that he was delighted to renew our acquaintance and to start teaching me Gujarati again. I wasn't particularly good at conversation. I had already studied Marathi, which he knew. But we used to spend, I should say, a very pleasant 1 hour or so every evening talking not only about Gujarati, but about everything else under the sun, you see.
The things they talked about couldn't always be pleasant. Outside the walls, India was seething with the great movement that Gandhi had called into being, and sometimes with things for which he had not called. Four men were to be hanged for murder.
Those four executions took place under terrific stress and strain, and we had about 50,000 to 100,000 people marching up from Pune city to the prison, marching and parading and demonstrating outside, and he could hear all this uproar going on, you see, protesting at their execution. Their execution was perfectly reasonable. I mean, they had actually burnt a policeman alive, an Indian policeman in Sholapur. I was in charge of the execution, and they were hanged early morning, one morning, and Gandhiji knew all about this. And he was very worried. And furthermore, what I felt about it was, I being in a feeling horrible about this execution and feeling dreadful, he had such terrific sympathy for me. And he said so And he said, well, I was worried about you. I felt how dreadful you must be feeling over this execution. He was a wonderful chap. No question about that. He realized that we had a job to do and it was our duty. He didn't argue about the ethics at all.
Lord Irwin, too, had a job to do. His aim was to move the whole question out of the battlefield of civil disobedience and into the constitution-making roundtable conference in London. After some time, Gandhi and the Congress leaders were released from detention. And then came what Winston Churchill described in the House of Commons as the humiliating spectacle of a half-naked fakir striding up the steps of the Viceroy's palace, there to negotiate and parley on equal terms with the representative of the King Emperor. The price that Gandhi knew he must ask in order to carry his Congress colleagues with him was an official inquiry into the conduct of the police during the struggle that had been checked but not abandoned.